You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
A lot of people ask me that. They always ask me, how old are you? How did you get into all of this? And all that kind of stuff. And I think it was all by chance. Part of it was by chance, but part of it was because of my own inquisitive nature. I've always been interested in science. So when I left school, I started a biomedical science degree. And even at that stage, I wasn't 100% sure I wanted to go into brain-related stuff. It wasn't until I was really fortunate to have been lectured by Sir Richard Fall, who's the director of the Centre for Brain Research, and I think I was hooked from there. He has this habit of hooking people in, and just the fact that there's so much about neurological disease that we don't know really attracted me to the field through his lectures. And brain anatomy is really fascinating, and it is the last frontier in terms of how we map out the body. And so I kind of got in from there. So after my undergraduate studies, I ended up pursuing a PhD with him. And I didn't know a lot about Huntington's disease at the time. When he talked about the project, what I really liked was that this studying this condition has sort of like the huge implications for other motor diseases too, like Parkinson's, and the fact that the disease involves a dysfunctional protein as well. It has common threads with Alzheimer's too. So part of me was like, oh, if I go down this track and get involved in working on Huntington's for my PhD, perhaps this will lead to not only cracking something for Huntington's, but also it's of relevance to a huge plethora of people with other neurological diseases. So that's how I got into Huntington's. But for my PhD, I guess I was really fortunate. A lot of students get real fixated on their projects and they focus predominantly on only their project work. I was really fortunate to meet families who are involved in, for example, brain donor programs at the Centre for Brain Research or clinical trials that are taking place across the road at the hospital. And they're heavily invested in our work, not only in terms of how they can contribute to research, but what we give them in terms of questions that they might have that we could answer and what have you. And I think my connection with some HD families is what led me into pursuing more independent research questions for my postdoctoral work. So that's how I ended up in everything. I really owe it to Richard Fall for stimulating my interest all the way back then. So this is this is like 2006 when I was an undergraduate student. So it was that long ago, and then here we are today, and I'm working with him.
That's awesome. Congrats. But also, I'll note on that, though, the fact that you have, and I can speak to this, such a close relationship to those families, and I mean, isn't that can be kind of exhausting if you're taking on all of that emotional side of things as well as the sort of scientific research. What's that like?
I think it keeps you real humble as a scientist. A lot of scientists get real fixated on simply their project question. They get fixated on their protein or their brain cell type that they're looking at. And seeing the human face to anything that they're working with really keeps them not only driven, humble as hell, because you think you're really good at what you're doing, and then they ask you something and you're like, wow, I never thought of that. So I think you could take it two ways. Sometimes I can't sleep at night if there's a question I've been asked and I'm not able to help or answer it straight away, especially if that comes from a family member, because I feel obliged to get back to them as soon as possible. But other times I feel real privileged. You know, there's some sort of like mana that comes with being able to help people in this way through our research. And, you know, it's not 9 to 5, the work that we do. And sometimes we don't even know how many hours we do a day. And part of that is, I could say it's attributable to families who give you that kind of boost. I reckon I wouldn't be as invested in my work if it wasn't for the families, actually. And sometimes they give you fantastic ideas. Yeah.
Do you know the word monarchy? Yes. The idea to sort of give or to be generous,
yes.
Right? I heard somebody explain that the breakdown of it is mana. Aki, so aki is to foster or to help with, right, or to encourage. And if you are encouraging or being manaki, right, you are also fostering your own mana, which
is that's beautiful,
right? Let's just start at the beginning. What is Huntington's?
Yes, because I just jumped into it. Yeah. It's just everyone should know by now, right? So Huntington's is typically classified as a neurodegenerative disease. Now, what does that mean? It means it causes the breakdown of brain cells over time. So that's neuro is brain, degenerative is breakdown over time. And so it falls into a similar kind of category of diseases as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. But what makes it a little bit more unique is that it has a genetic signature where if a person has this specific gene for the disease, they're likely to manifest it. And so you can kind of classify the disease then as a hereditary, genetic, neurological disorder. And those are a lot of big words, but essentially what that means, it's a brain condition that can be passed down potentially from generation to generation, because there's a 50% chance of passing the gene on if you have the disease. And so this is what makes it a really interesting disorder to study from a scientific perspective as well, is because we have a unique population of people that kind of guide us and give us samples of whether that's things like blood or brain or even their time, for which we can then find out new drug targets or new clues for the disease. Unlike Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, where it's a little bit more sporadic, it's a little bit more random. It's often harder to have community-based research for those kind of conditions. Yeah.
That's interesting. I never thought of it like that.
I call it a model disease because it's almost like a model condition that researchers studying other conditions can learn from. Part of the reason why I see it as a model is, okay, if you have a brain condition that causes brain cell death, it has commonalities with many others that also cause brain cell death. If you have a condition that has sort of like a motor impairment of some kind, then it's also linked with other conditions that have motor impairment, because the parts of the brain that are affected are kind of similar in certain ways. So Huntington's is a super duper model because it also involves a bad protein. Now, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, motor neuron disease all involve bad proteins. And the breakdown of those pathways that create these bad proteins have common features. This is why Huntington's is the model.
Right. Can you explain the bad protein?
Remember I was talking about the gene, the genetic mutation that causes Huntington's. So the gene is called the IT15 gene. I don't want to go into the boring stuff about it, but really it was discovered in 1993. And what's really cool is a team of Kiwi researchers were involved in the discovery of that gene in 93. Russell Snell, Richard Fall, and that whole team were involved. And this gene is responsible for various things. The main thing is that it produces a protein called Huntington. Normal people who don't have Huntington's, for example, they have Huntington too. So we all have Huntington. The protein in people who have the condition, though, has this propensity to clump up together and form these what we call inclusions, or sort of like aggregate type round balls that are present in different brain cell types. And we think that that protein, that clumpiness of it, is what could be triggering or leading to or in some way contributing towards the brain cell death that occurs. So the idea is to get rid of the bad protein, but because you have a gene that also produces the good protein, you need to ensure that you keep enough of the good protein, because that protein's actually critical for us to live. If you take an animal study, for example, and you turn off that gene, the Huntington gene, the animals don't live for more than a couple of days. So we actually need the protein to survive. And so this is what's posed real challenges for researchers, because they're trying to figure out what makes the bad protein so different to the good one.
Okay. I want to just touch on the fact that that was discovered in the 90s, right?
But yes.
People still had Huntington's before this, but we didn't know much about it.
Yeah.
So after the 90s, you have this kind of big breakthrough information that you can use and also respond to, and then start more research and try and get cures.
Yes.
Basically.
Yes.
Where are we at now? Because we haven't had really as big a breakthrough as that until recently, yeah. Right? But this is a big deal.
This is a big deal. Yes.
A moment.
Yes, it is a big deal. And the reason why is when the gene was discovered in 93, all the researchers were like, yeah, eureka, all we have to do is turn the gene off and we've cured the disease. That's it. And then when they quickly realize that, oh crap, if we turn it off too much, then we're going to cause more harm than good, they were stuck. So for many, many years, people did a lot of what we call mechanistic research to try and figure out what this protein does. And then all these new techniques came into play as potential therapeutics for other diseases. So some of them you might have heard of as CRISPR, which is a gene editing technique. But at the same time, there were other techniques called putting in small molecules like modified genetic pieces of information and kind of like changing the production of certain proteins. And so these little molecules, for example, are called antisense oligonucleotides. And so people have been playing with these molecules like CRISPR and antisense since the late 90s, early 2000s, but they were mucking around with them in cell lines, so just cells in a dish, and in small animal models. It was very much in its infancy, and they didn't know that it was going to be something that could be really, really huge until they started doing targeted use of these different molecules. So long story cut short, the one I referred to, the antisense oligonucleotides, they found that they could deliver them via lumbar puncture into small animals that have Huntington's introduced to them. What they discovered was that those small animal models had reduced Huntington expression, and they'd also reversed the symptoms. They'd also reverse cell death, and it was a huge deal. But then people like me were a bit more conservative. Hang on, okay, you might have improved Huntington's in a rat. Doesn't mean you're going to improve Huntington's in a human. We need more evidence. And so these researchers, researchers don't have money. Let me say one thing. Researchers don't have enough money. And often what they have to do is when they have a huge idea, they have to partner up with big pharma to bring it out into something bigger. So what happened was the researchers that were dealing with the small animals eventually managed to prove that this drug, the antisense oligonucleotide, was able to lower the amounts of that bad Huntington in larger animal models, including mm-hmm. primates. Mm-hmm. Then suddenly, a big pharma company called Ionis started sniffing in on what's going on. And so they invested a bit of money to do a really, really small trial with 46 patients. So this is in the UK, Canada, and Germany. So these patients were like the heroes, the first heroes that were willing to try this antisense oligonucleotide. And essentially what the antisense does is we all have genes and they all produce proteins, but there's a little message in between them called the messenger. We call that messenger RNA. Mm-hmm. This antisense oligonucleotide binds to that RNA and slows it down. And that's how the bad protein is produced at lower levels.
So we're talking basically a slowing down of the increase in
the protein.
Which is going to gradually affect your brain.
And it's working on the assumption that that protein is the only thing that's causing the disease, okay. And that's the only thing that's happening. So this was, it was kind of like a punt, really. And so what they found in these group of individuals who were early Huntington's, when they trialed this drug in them using lumbar puncture, none of them got worse.
Right. Okay, wait there. Let's explain early Huntington's, because you've got, say, symptoms that begin at a certain age based on your CAG count, yes. Which you might need to explain.
Yes. So remember that bad gene I was talking about. The protein that's produced is based on a polyglutamine repeat called a CAG expansion. In normal people, we have kind of 38 to 39 or less of those repeats. But in a patient with Huntington's, they tend to have 38 to 39 or more, and they have an expanded repeat which produces that abnormal protein. And so
the general sort of understanding of it is that the higher your repeat is, the earlier your symptoms will begin.
It's general. It's not always the case. There are other factors that can contribute to an earlier or later onset, but in majority of the cases, that is correct. There are other impacts on CAG repeat length expansion and age of onset, but yeah, that's another talk for another time.
There's so many other questions I want to ask, but
please do.
Let's go back though to, so in terms of the Ionis drug.
Yes, okay, that's where I was.
Let's say that.
Yeah.
You've got people that you're testing with that have not been symptomatic yet.
Yes.
So those early heroes.
But they did have subtle symptoms.
Okay.
So we call them early, like they're showing early signs of the disease, as in they're not full blown, had it for quite a few years and are, you know, have a lot of brain cell death. These are people that would have very subtle signs, more likely, you know, to have brain cell dysfunction as opposed to the death of brain cells. So they're really good candidates because then you can kind of monitor over time whether something gets worse based on their symptoms. Mm-hmm. So they have to show something. So they might have subtle motor signs or subtle mood signs of the disease. So they have to measure that against that.
And what we saw was that their symptoms didn't get worse.
Didn't get worse. But that's prelim. Okay. And it was only, from my memory, it was a follow-up of maybe a year or 18 months. Because that trial started in 2015 and they ended it at the end of 2017 with that huge announcement that the bad protein expression is lower and dose dependently lower in the cerebral spinal fluid from the spinal tap lumbar puncture of those patients.
Massive.
Because this was the first line of evidence in humans of lowering that bad protein. But what I want to say, and for the record, is they haven't followed up long enough yet to see whether big symptoms change over time, because we essentially have to wait for those patients to age.
Exactly. And you're also talking not necessarily people that have quite a lot of symptoms or are quite late stage, right? Do we know if they can reverse those symptoms, or do we know if they can stop them there, and what does that look like?
You and I both have the same questions. Okay. And I think, to be honest, we have to look at what's the most important thing. The most important thing is for those individuals who are not at the stage of showing the disease, who are perhaps near that age of onset, this type of work is the most beneficial for them. When you're quite far gone and there's already a lot of brain cell death, this type of drug option is not going to do a lot for you, because the mechanism of this drug is focusing on that protein. And remember, this protein forms in cells. So if the cells are already gone, the protein's probably not there anyway.
Right. So this is one path, though, isn't it? It's one way of dealing with this, and you did mention CRISPR, so the idea of gene editing. Are these all of these other paths, are they still being developed as well?
Absolutely. So what's happened is, since this drug by Ionis was then kind of partnered up and brought out by Roche, right, a whole lot of other drug companies have entered a race, which is great for the Huntington's community. I know everyone's scared of big pharma, but when it comes to dealing with rarer conditions like Huntington's, getting help from pharmaceutical companies actually allows the researchers to implement their work out there, and that's one of the most difficult things with research. And so now we have about three or four companies that are developing variants of this drug. So one of the, I guess you could say one of the caveats to this current drug, the ASO I was talking about, is that it affects both the normal and the bad protein. We want to develop a drug that affects only the bad protein.
Right.
And the bad protein, its structure was only really mapped out last year. And so now we've got better versions of this drug that are being made and are being tested on large animals and early human trials. But then you were talking about CRISPR. There is a gene, a gene-based delivery system that is also being trialed, but that's only at the stages of large animal models at the moment. So I can't comment on whether that's going to humans. At the moment, there are about 95 potential sites around the world. Well, between 80 and 95 potential sites around the world that are going to get in on the third phase of this trial.
Okay.
It is possible that Australia and New Zealand will be included in that, because we've got some fantastic researchers that are keen to get involved.
Working on it.
But we won't find out until early next year which sites are included. As at October 2018, no formal announcement was made about the other countries apart from the US, the UK and Canada that are being involved. So I sense this announcement's going to come out either late this year before Christmas or early next year in the new year.
Okay.
Yeah.
I did want to continue, and I want to ask all of the things. Is there anything else you want to add at the moment about any of that? Because I'm thinking maybe what we could do is talk to you in the new year again. And check out those sorts of developments and see if New Zealand has been announced or anything like that.
I think one thing I really want to say is that all of us researchers, we're working together for the families to try and push out this onset of this disease, and not only for the sake of the families that are going through it, but also for people suffering from other neurological conditions too. And for us, you know, the work we do in the Center for Brain Research really complements all the work that they're doing to develop these trials, because at the end of the day, even if you develop a drug, if you don't know how to give it, where to give it, or what it's targeting, there's no real point in putting it in people. So for us, this is a huge win as well, because it also keeps us super duper charged and empowered to carry on with our research too.
Let me add though that, well, one, thank you for coming in. I know you're an incredibly busy woman, and it did take some time to kind of book in this interview because of that. And I did want to say that you were a finalist for Woman of the Year and a Kiwibank New Zealand Local Hero Regional Medal recipient. Is that right?
Yeah, that was over the past couple of months, there's been a few announcements, yes.
How's that feel? Congratulations.
Thank you. You know, it's a really humbling feeling, because sometimes I feel like a bit of a fraud. It's really nice to receive this acknowledgement from the community for the work that we're doing, not only in the laboratory, but also to share our research with the wider communities. And I'm really honoured to be able to be amongst those people that really live and breathe the work that they do. And for me I just feel like I'm doing my job. I don't feel like I'm doing anything particularly extraordinary, and I'm just stoked that the community really appreciates it. And for us, you know, if we didn't have the community to work for, we wouldn't have jobs. And so from a science point of view, we really need the people as much as they need us. And I think these type of awards, I take them on behalf of the Huntington's community that have really brought me up there and encouraged me to keep going. You know, you guys are my heroes. It's really not about me. It's about them.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/becasts.